Recording?
Okay, excellent. All right, so welcome back everybody from lunch. Did everybody have a good lunch? Yes? Everyone got enough to eat? Yes, more or less? And everyone ate mindfully? Well, that's not too bad, okay? That's not too bad. And I was very happy to see that you were getting a chance to have a bit of a chat and talk to each other. And this is part of the Eightfold Path. Curiously enough, do you want to read what the Buddha had to say about taking a vow of silence? You've done retreats before?
Yeah.
Right? Did you take a vow of silence on retreats?
Yeah.
Do you want to know what the Buddha said about taking a vow of silence?
Yeah.
Yeah, let's see that. Okay. That'll be fun. Before we do that, we'll come to that in a minute. Before we do that, I want to give you a little bit of a background of what we're doing here. Now, up in front of you here is a slide for Sutta Central. Sutta Central is the website that I'm helping to manage. And can anybody... Okay, so the word Sutta Central... Can anybody tell me what the word Sutta means?
Thread.
Sorry?
Thread.
A thread. A thread. Oh, right. Okay, Sutta means a thread. Pretty good, yeah. Something like that. So this is all about sewing. More or less. I mean, it's an interesting kind of metaphor because in English we say you're weaving a yarn or you're spinning a tale or something, right? And historically the reason for that is because many of the stories that we have were passed down through women's sewing circles. And that was a big part of women's work. Sit there weaving the thread, sewing and telling each other yarns while you're doing it. And so this metaphor was passed down. If you're interested in that kind of idea, Marina Warner wrote this great book, From the Beast to the Blonde. So she goes into a lot of detail showing how a lot of these stories that we have were passed down among women's sewing circles and then appropriated by blokes who then made them into Disney movies and made billions of dollars out of them. So that's called evolution. And, okay. Anyway, so sutta is a thread. And simile is actually given that the sutta is like the Dhamma is like a garland of flowers. And if you don't have a thread to tie them together, then when the wind comes, they'll be scattered and disappeared. So the sutta is there to tie the Dhamma together and to preserve it and to keep it for future generations. Okay, so the root meaning of sutta is a thread. Can anybody tell me, like when we talk about a sutta or a sutra in Buddhist contexts, what do we mean? A word, a discourse, a teaching? Okay, fair enough. And let me see. Let's just give an example. You've heard of the Satipatthana Sutta. Is that correct?
Yes.
Most people have heard of it? Okay, that's good. When I travel around, I don't know who people are, so I don't know what you know of or anything like that. So if somebody hasn't heard, is there anyone here who's never heard of a sutta or what a sutta is? It's okay, don't be ashamed. That's okay, everyone knows, okay. Satipatthana Sutta, you've all heard of that. Can anybody tell me briefly what the Satipatthana Sutta is? No, not any of the bikinis, please, because that's cheating. You're experts, okay? Somebody, yes.
Mindfulness of breathing.
Satipatthana Sutta is mindfulness of breathing.
Well, maybe I didn't say it well, but
it certainly includes teachings on mindfulness of breathing, yes.
Mm-hmm.
But what is the Satipatthana Sutta?
Four
Foundations of Mindfulness is a translation of the word Satipatthana, not a very good one, I might add. But it is a translation. But what is the Satipatthana Sutta?
Well, Satipatthana Sutta just goes through four domains of mindfulness.
Okay.
And explains what are the categories to pay
attention okay.
to. It's like a guide.
Okay, thank you. So the Satipatthana Sutta is a discourse, which is a guide to the four Satipatthanas. That's correct. So that's the description of the Satipatthana Sutta. But what actually is the Satipatthana Sutta? Like materially and physically, what are we referring to when we refer to the Satipatthana Sutta?
Text.
A text? Okay. No, that's the four Satipatthanas, but when we're referring to the Satipatthana Sutta, what are we actually referring to? That's somebody said a text.
A discourse,
okay. Right. Good. Good. This is all correct, but like, what is it? Like physically, what is it? Like, if I say, you know, the Golden Gate Bridge, and somebody says, well, it's a device for getting people from one side of the harbour to the other. Of course, yes, it is. Like, what is it? And you can point to it and say, you go there, that's what it is, okay? So I'm asking you to point to it and say, where is it? How? Physically, where? What kind of thing is it? Thank you. Thank you. Very sensible answer, right? Okay, something that appears on your computer, right? And... or on a book, if I'm reading it in a book, okay? But what exactly is it? So in the Buddhist traditions, we have bunches of scriptures, right? Those scriptures have been passed down for a long time. And those scriptures are today, or in the 20th century, were compiled into books. And in some of those books was something called the Majjhima Nikaya, the middle-length discourses. There's another collection called the Digha Nikaya, long discourses and so on. These days we put them all on digital format and you can read them on your screen, which we're going to do in a minute. Now, a discourse is a teaching that the Buddha gives in a certain... Tell me if I'm correct, okay? See, a discourse is a teaching which the Buddha gives in a certain time and place on a certain topic. Something like that?
Yes.
Now, with the Satipatthana Sutta, notice the use of the definite article there. The Satipatthana Sutta. We have one in Majjhima Nikaya, number 10, and one in the Digha Nikaya, number 22. Which one is it?
That's
number 10. Is that the one? And what's the DN one? Right? So this is getting complicated, isn't it? You thought... See, you guys don't know me very well yet. So when we come down to this class, you probably thought that my job would be to take something complicated and make it simple. No. My job is to take something simple and make it complicated. Yeah. Okay? So, right, so it's that. Now, when you read... The Satipatthana Sutta, what does it say? So it starts out with something like, thus have I heard, one time the Buddha was staying in Kamasada. Is that correct? Okay, very good. And is that what the Buddha said?
No.
No, why not? Well, I'm speaking English, right? That's a problem. Okay, right. So, first of all, it's a translation, and secondly, it's a package, right? It's a thing which is put around the Buddha's words, okay? So, is the Satipatthana Sutta, maybe is that the Pali text? Is that the Satipatthana Sutta? Here we have Sutta Central, it's a website. And so as a website, it has a bunch of data, and we organize Buddhist scriptures and so on. And we have texts in different languages. We have root languages, Pali, Sanskrit, Chinese, Tibetan, and a few other obscure Indic languages. And we have translations in modern languages. So the Buddha said you should learn language, Dhamma in your own language. So we have translations in English and Spanish and Portuguese and Indonesian and Sinhala and Burmese and Thai. And Arabic and Klingon. You guys think I'm joking? Why does no one take me seriously? So when we read the suttas, we read suttas in translations, right? And where are we now? And we can read different translations, for example, in Sindarin by Galadriel.
Oh, wow.
Nice, right?
That's very pretty.
Very pretty. So any hardcore Tolkien geeks can read the Metta Sutta. Sorry? This is in Sindarin. This is one of the Elvish languages from The Lord of the Rings.
No, really?
Yes, this is the Metta Sutta in the Elvish language from The Lord of the Rings. There may be one or two geeks who have worked on Sutta Central. Anyway, so my point here being, so this is the Metta Sutta, and see, on Sutta Central we try to handle the Buddha's discourses, and one of the things that we want to try to share with people, try to communicate through the way that we built the site and the way that we approach things, is that a sutta is actually a whole kind of complex of things. So the Buddha taught 2,500 years ago, and he taught these different discourses, and they were memorized, they were passed down, they were put into collections, later on they were written down, then they were translated, and so on. And so we have, the technical term we use inside Sutta Central, is this card is a suttaplex, right? So it's a complex of information about a sutta, including translations, parallels, and so on and so forth. So this is what we deal with when we're working with Sutta Central, is the suttas and these different parallels and relations between different parts of the canon. So just to take most of these don't have many parallels. What have we got here? The Kumarapanha. Okay, so we have here the Mangala Sutta. People have heard of the Mangala Sutta? Many people. Okay, so in the Mangala Sutta we have this version here in the Kuddhikapata. There's another version in Pali in the Suttanipata, and there are two versions in Chinese. So these are, I believe, in the Chinese Vinaya texts, and so there are sets of verses which have been translated from an Indic language, probably Sanskrit or Gandhari or something like that, into Chinese, and then preserved and passed down. No, actually, it's not a Vinaya text, is it? Let's say... I'm not exactly sure what that is. Maybe a Jataka-style text or something. Can anyone remember that? T200. Sorry? It says Dhammapada. Oh, okay, maybe it's in Dhammapada. Yeah, right, yeah. Okay. So, I don't read Chinese, but anyway. So, this is what we do on Sutta Central. And so we try to present these in a way that is useful for people who want to just read suttas, whether you're reading it in English or in Klingon. Seriously, the Klingons have been at war with the Federation for such a long time that surely there's got to be some of them who think to themselves, there's got to be another way. Right?
Yeah.
Right? And we are there for them. We are ready for them. When they come, we have the Metta Sutta that they can read. Yes. Yes. Yes.
It's Ananda saying this. But,
no.
Not Ananda, somebody else. Okay. But also, I talked to Kaz Tanahashi recently. He translates things with Dogen.
Okay.
And so I talked about Gil translating the Dhammapada.
Right.
Oh, no, he interpreted it. I said, no, you don't get it. He translated it. He said, no, that's an interpretation. But that all of the translations are interpretations, is what he's saying.
Sure.
And also that we don't say... it doesn't start Buddha, and I say this. It's always stuff that I heard. But
right.
But there's always a sense of bringing it into somebody's life, you know.
Right. Right. Yeah. Good point. Yeah. So this is you know what it's about. But look, they're actually. Friends of mine, Brambhala Nalia and Rod Bucknell, did a translation of the Madhyama Agama, and in the foreword they put a quote from an ancient Chinese scholar, like one of the. I can't remember who it was now, and the translation of the quote was, translation is interpretation. And so, I mean, we try to have a sense of integrity about that, right? So you try to interpret it in a transparent way, right? But owning the fact that it is an interpretation is part of the process. It's one of the key pieces that I learned from my friend Ajahn Brahmali, and he said when you're translating, because often you reach points and when you're translating you're not quite sure what it means. So I'll just do this slow water while we're going. And but one thing that we can say with quite a high degree of confidence is that the Buddha was kind of probably fairly sensible. And that when he said things, that they probably meant something. So even if we're not quite sure, you should translate it as if it means something. We know that if you translate it in a meaningless way, you're almost certainly wrong. Right? And this is really meaningful for translators, because very often you reach points in translation, you're like, actually, I don't quite know what that means, so I'll just translate it literally. The dictionary says this word means this, so I'll put that in there. Good enough. Right? I mean, sometimes you don't really have much of a choice and you have to do that, but most of the time you really just try and say, well, how can I translate this in a way that's meaningful? Yeah. But to come back to your earlier point about Venerable Ananda being the one who passes down who said, thus have I heard, does everybody here know what we're talking about when we say that? Yes? No?
Yes.
Who's Venerable Ananda? Okay, yeah. They're good? Everyone knows about that? Okay, so I've now navigated through sort of central to Majjhima Nikaya number one, and it begins with, thus have I heard. Now, because sort of central is awesome, you could do that. And now we have the Pali and English. Yeah, I told you. Told you it was awesome. Okay. So have I heard, eva me sutang. Now, according to what the traditions say, is what you've said, that this is the word of Venerable Ananda, who comes along and says, thus have I heard, and he's repeating what was recited at the first council. This is what the traditions say. So, again, just a bit of necessary background. During the Buddha's lifetime, that various discourses were preserved and memorized and passed down, and they were organized and codified soon after the Buddha's death in Rajagaha at an event called the First Council. That's according to the traditional account. And the traditions tell us that the words eva me sutang, which occur at the beginning in theory of every sutta, are spoken by Venerable Ananda as a record of what he heard the Buddha say. Now, that's certainly incorrect. Why can we say it's certainly incorrect? Because the word thus have I heard occurs in other contexts in the suttas that make it clear what it means. The word thus have I heard is a signifier that indicates that you were not present at the events that you're talking about. Okay? It's in Pali they have another idiom, which is sammukha me sutang. I heard it in the presence. And if you say I heard this and learned this in the Buddha's presence, that's what you say. Sammukha me bhagavato sutang sammukha patigahitang. And if there's a discourse where somebody is talking to Venerable Anuruddha, that's just an example, and he asks Venerable Anuruddha a question, and he says, ask him a question about the gods and about devas of various kinds. And Anuruddha says, well, that's a very rude question, because you shouldn't be asking those kinds of things about a meditator's personal meditation experience, but nevertheless I'll answer you. And he goes on to answer the question about the gods. And then the man he's talking to is silent for a minute, and he says, it occurs to me, Venerable, that you don't say, thus have I heard. Which suggests to me that you must have been present there and actually seen these devas yourself, and you're speaking from your own experience. Right? So you can see what's happening? If he'd said, thus have I heard, it would mean I wasn't there, but this is what I'm passing down as a rumor. Okay? So that's what I heard, isn't the voice of Ananda, because obviously he was there. I'll come back to you in a second. He was there, at least much of the time, right? And so eva me sutang, rather, should be understood as the signifier by the early tradition to say that this is something which has been passed down by the tradition. A later date became attributed to Ananda. Sorry, yes?
Yeah, I'm still
can be used in this way somewhere, but it may not be enforced everywhere. And then when Ananda was choosing a particular introductory phrase, it's like a stamp that's authenticity, he may choose it, but he didn't want to, you know, to have two frames
okay.
to start his sutta. So maybe you're right, but I think it's not what you brought about, and it's not enough evidence to say that this is.
Thank you so much. I am so thrilled to have somebody in the audience who's not just going to believe all of the rubbish that I'm putting out there. When I was in, I did a conference in Australia some years ago, and we had a chat with, there was an Aboriginal fellow who was doing a talk there, and one of the things that I learned from him, because you see, when they pass down their information and their education for their children and for their people, it really kind of matters. We were talking in the car on the way down here about like people these days saying, oh, they don't have to bother learning maths because who cares, you never learn it, use it in the real world, right? But for Aboriginal education, it's not like that because it's about where do you find water? And when those trees are flowering, that you can travel 100 kilometres down the coast and the fish will be coming in. And when you see the blue colour on those hills over there, that means that you know that the yams are starting to appear in the swamps down there. And so it's your map and your guide to the world. And if you get it wrong, you're stuck in the middle of the desert and you don't really have much to fall back on. So it's really important that these lessons are passed down reliably and so on. But the problem is, just as we have a problem that we were discussing earlier with transmission and authority and authenticity, they have the same problem because their essence. And I was told, I had another conversation with another Aboriginal elder who we sat down and we were talking, and the first thing he said was, the essence of Aboriginal philosophy is impermanence. And when we look at it, we think, oh, it's this timeless land, right? It's timeless wisdom. No, it's about impermanence. It's about the changes. That's what they have to understand. And the fact that for 1,000 years, people have passed down a song that tells of a waterhole there does not mean that there's going to be a waterhole there tomorrow. Yeah? So they have to know this. So every so often, they lie to their students, to their kids. They tell them, oh, there's a creek over in that hill, you know, go over there and find it. And there isn't a creek in that hotel, in that hill. And they wander around the hills, thirsty for a couple of days before they make their way back. And the parents are like, well, you should have known, right? You should have seen that the birds weren't there, the flowers weren't growing. You should have been paying attention. Right, so part of the education is to teach them that you can't always rely on that old wisdom. And so I'm glad I don't lie to you, like not deliberately, but I'm glad that you keep that in mind, that not everything that you might be hearing is necessarily going to be correct. So you pointed out that quite correctly, words are used in different ways in different contexts. Absolutely, of course. So what reason do we have to believe this? Okay, so let me just say a couple of pointers. I'll just look at another passage in a minute. Just a couple of things. Number one thing is that when we are reading and interpreting ancient texts, our number one guide is the idiomatic usage within the texts themselves. And our primary way of learning is to first of all pay attention to those contexts that are clear and unambiguous. Okay? Now, a context like this is not clear and unambiguous, right? It just says, thus I've heard, and it goes on. It's not really telling us what this phrase means or what the context is. It's just sitting there. Whereas in those contexts that I was telling you before, in those contexts, it is pretty clear exactly what it means in those contexts. Right? So, yes, it's true. It might mean something in a different context. But until we have reason to believe that, then we should, generally speaking, as a good textual procedure is to infer from well-known contexts to less well-known or less well-defined contexts. That's how we work. So that's one thing. But let me just come on to address that. Where are we now? Oops, I just did that. Sorry. Here we go. Let's have a look now. Okay. Oh, I was afraid we'd have nothing to talk about. Okay. We mentioned before that we have the suttas. Now, another part of the Buddhist scriptures is what we call the Vinaya. Right? I am going to answer your question, but I'm just going to meander around to it a little bit, okay? So I'll get there. So, Vinaya. Who can tell me what is the Vinaya? Rules. Sorry? Rules for monks. What about for nuns? Okay. Rules for monastics. Okay. So this is the Vinaya. Okay, it's not wrong, right? But it's not completely right either. So this is the Vinaya. Let me open up a book of the Vinaya. This is called the Khandikas. It's part of the Vinaya. Let me open up a translation of this. Thus have I heard the Buddha was staying... one time the Buddha was staying in Uruvela on the bank of the river Niranjara, paid attention to dependent origination, arising and ceasing, and then spoke the verse, truly when things grow plain to the ardent meditating Brahman, his doubts all vanish, in that he comprehends things with a cause. Is that a rule? No. Point being that Vinaya includes lots of things, including Dhamma teachings and stories and backgrounds and procedures and guidelines, some fantastic, very inspiring descriptions of how to keep your toilet clean. Right? I mean, these things are like super useful. And so it includes many different things, but generally speaking, it's a guide or an education for Buddhist monks and nuns, including rules, but also including a lot of other things about the lifestyle, which is giving you guidance for how we should be living, and so on. All right, so this is the Vinaya. Now, and I should mention, like, there's lots of them, right? So here's Vinaya, there's the Pali Vinaya. That's usually when people say the Vinaya, that's what they mean. And here's like a Mahasanghika one, and another Mahasanghika one, Chinese and Sanskrit, Lokuttaravada, Mahishasika in Chinese, Dharmaguptaka, another Dharmaguptaka in Prakrit. Oh my goodness. Sarvastivada in Chinese, another Sarvastivada in Sanskrit, and Mula Sarvastivada in Chinese, Sanskrit, and Tibetan. Oh, and then an other category with a bunch of other things in it. Oh, crikey. So now you know why all the monastics look so stressed and worried all the time. So all of these are recensions and versions of the Vinaya, which has been passed down by the Buddhist schools. And so in the different monastic communities, right, you can imagine that different monastic communities, you inherit a group of the basic rules and procedures and principles which the Buddha taught, but you also, there are various other ones which are, you know, maybe added and evolve over time. And sometimes you can see that these are quite sort of culturally specific. So, for example, there's one Vinaya belongs to a school. Do we have it here? One Vinaya belongs to a school called the Haimawata School. Do we have that listed there? Maybe we don't have it. Oh, I think it's this one, actually. Anyway, it belongs to the Haimawata School, which is the Himalayan school. And in that Vinaya, one of the monks goes up to the Buddha and says, it's really cold where we're living. Can we wear warm jackets? And the Buddha says, sure. Right? Okay, so you can see it's very kind of localized. There's another Vinaya, the Dharmaguptaka Vinaya, which is also interesting. The Dharmaguptaka Vinaya is the Vinaya which is followed and practiced in the Chinese and East Asian traditions. And Dharmaguptaka Vinaya, I believe, was descended from a monk called Yonaka Dhammarakita, who was a Greek monk. Okay, so it's begun from a Greek school, Vinaya school. And one of the eccentricities of that particular school is it has a lot of rules about the stupa, including rules like don't pee on a stupa. which I think we don't have in the Pali Vinaya, but I think we can all agree is a good idea, right? So no peeing on stupa. And another one which is also very interesting is no Buddha images in the toilet. Which I don't know whether you've noticed that, but today I've noticed a few Buddha images in toilets around the place. Look, if you've got a Buddha image in your toilet, no offense, but maybe somewhere else might be a more respectful place. I don't think the Buddha wants to spend his life watching watching what he's doing. It always kind of struck me that, like, this is something that you see in Western Buddhism. You never see it in Asian Buddhism. And so I think that, well, the Greeks in the old days must have been the same. They didn't really get the custom, so they were quite okay with peeing on stupas. And so they had to make a rule there saying no peeing on stupas. So anyway, so these things can be sometimes culturally specific. Okay. So all of these things are passed down in the Buddhist traditions. And now most of us will be mostly familiar with the Pali texts, and the Pali texts are the canonical scriptures of the Theravadin school. And even though we have these riches of texts from many different places, the Pali texts still have a very special and central place. The Pali texts are the only complete set of scriptures that we have from an early Buddhist school. Other scriptures we have parts, sometimes quite a lot of them, but they're still Pali collection, we have the complete collection. Pali collection is the only collection that's preserved in its whole in a unified early Indic dialect. Okay, other ones are either later dialects or their translations. Pali is the only set of literature that has been passed down together with an extensive and detailed set of commentaries. And the commentaries are indispensable for answering so many questions, problems in reading them. And the Pali texts are also the only scripture which has been a continuous part of a living Buddhist tradition from that time till today. Whereas the other Buddhist scriptures, of course, are part of a living Buddhist tradition, but not really in the same way. Like in most of the Mahayana countries, they will pass down the suttas, but they're mostly reading and studying the Mahayana sutras. So that the actual early suttas, they're there, and many of the teachings are then shared in common with the other sutras, but the actual early suttas themselves are not really so central in the Buddhist culture as they are in the Theravada. So these are some of the reasons why, even just from a linguistic or scholarly point of view, that the Pali scriptures have always been and will always be the cornerstone of our study and understanding of what the Buddha taught and what we call early Buddhism. Now, who can tell me, so I've been talking about Pali suttas, who can tell me what is Pali?
Popular scholarly book, Pankha, that was used by the monks over a wide area to overcome their various local dialects.
Okay, so it's a language, yeah, from...
Prakrit.
It's a Prakrit?
Dialect.
A Prakrit dialect. Excellent, thank you for that.
Magadha
Bhasa, yeah. Okay. Okay. Anyone else? Yeah. It's closely related to Sanskrit, but it's probably not quite right to say it came from Sanskrit. Certainly Vedic Sanskrit is one of the main linguistic kind of sources and relations. What we know of as classical Sanskrit was actually codified after Pali. And most of the... Like Panini lived about a century after the Buddha. So there was Sanskrit before, but it was an evolving language. Like if you know Sanskrit and you read the Rig Veda, it's quite different. Yeah, I mean, it's like reading Chaucer or something like that if you know English. So it's a close relation to Sanskrit. Yeah.
I just would like to add that before, to be more specific, before Panini, you say it's codified the Sanskrit. Before Panini, there were other Sanskrit.
Right.
Many grammars, they were much more bulky and extensive and big. Mm. So when Panini basically created Panini Sutra, which were very concise. So it's not exact to say that Panini codified Sanskrit, but he basically condensed all the prior grammatical knowledge.
Right, yeah, and the Pali Suttas refer to those early grammars, yeah, but we don't actually have any of them.
Yeah,
Yeah. Right. So, okay. So, we have some information or understanding what Pali... Does anyone here... Obviously, you guys know quite a bit what you're talking about. Does anyone here speak Pali or read Pali? You do? Excellent. Nice webinar. Anyone else? No, I'm just checking. All right, so, Pali. Now, the Pali texts that we read... Okay, let's have a look at a Pali text. So here we have this Vinaya text. And I haven't forgotten the thing about the vow of silence either. The Vinaya, the Pali text is here. And now, who can tell me where does this Pali text come from? Yes, good. That's what I like. I like concrete, real, and specific answers. Right? A server?
A server, I believe you said it was in the Silicon Valley area.
It is, yeah. It's just around here. Yeah. Sort of central is going to be faster here than it is anywhere else, probably. Okay, so that's true. It's coming from a server somewhere down the road in Silicon Valley. Okay. How did it get onto there? What is the road? Like, because we have these things. Like, how did it get there? From Sri Lanka, Sixth Council. Anyone else?
Oral?
On strips, palm leaves? Okay, so I'm hearing lots of bits of things. All of those bits of things are true, but I'm not really hearing a story. Like where did this, how did this text come onto this place? Does anyone know? I don't expect you to know, I'm just interested to know if anyone knows. No, incidentally, no. My friend Blake got it ready, so this particular one, so... But fair enough. Anybody else know where this text, why can we read the suttas here in this way?
It would have been remembered by Rupa Banikas that were specialized in that collection.
Okay.
It would have been recited orally in a proof text.
Okay.
By the monks in a sangha, so to sustain the accuracy of it. Then at the time when the monk's order was in danger of failing in Sri Lanka, and right. There was also competition from Sanskrit texts and a desire to protect the position of Pali texts, then they were committed to writing for the first time in the first century of the Common Era.
Okay.
And then remember that
dot dot dot, okay.
They tried to regularize them.
Okay. Okay, okay, good. Thank you for that. That's filled in a lot of gaps, right? That's very helpful. Still, it still hasn't quite got us from there to here, but you said something about said something about Buddhist councils, and you mentioned something about the Sixth Council. So can somebody tell us what was the Sixth Council? Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Such deep and penetrating wisdom. Yes. And tell us more.
Big meeting.
Okay. Fair enough. Can anybody else share any details about the Sixth Council? No? Okay, so the Sixth Council was a meeting which was held in Myanmar in the 1950s. It was over a few years, I think. It was like 55 to 57 or something like that. And it was to celebrate what they call the Buddha Jayanti. So according to the traditional dating, that was 2,500 years after the Buddha. So there was a global celebration of that in the Buddhist era. And, you know, it wasn't just a an arbitrary date or celebration of the Buddha, but also... had a lot of cultural significance within the Buddhist countries because for many of those countries it was also celebrating their independence from colonialism. And they had fairly recently escaped the yoke of colonialism and were rediscovering their own paths, their own identities, and their own also shared spiritual heritage across the Buddhist world. And so there was a lot of ceremonies and events at that time. And one of the more important or significant ones was the Buddha Jayanti, the Sixth Council. So as the number will inform you, there's been a number of councils over the years. The Fifth Council was in Myanmar in the late 19th century. The Sixth Council was in Myanmar in the mid-20th century. And they had monks from Burma, Thailand and Sri Lanka come together to recite the scriptures. The mainline recension of that was done by the Burmese monks. Mahasi Sayadaw was the questioner, and was his monk's name, Wichitta something something, was the responder, and he recited it all off by heart. And I believe from a friend of mine, a monk I knew, Venerable Jyoti Dhirasekara, was present, and according to him, it's not really an international edition as such, basically just the Burmese edition, and the Sri Lankan monks did their edition, and the Thai monks did their edition, and so on. So the Sixth Council, what we know of as the Sixth Council edition, was essentially the version that was prepared by the Burmese monks at that council. In Sri Lanka, of course, they have the Buddha Jayanti edition, which is the version prepared by the Sri Lankan monks from that council. Anyway, the differences between them are very minor, of course, but they have a slightly different flavour in the different spellings and things like that sometimes. Anyway, so that edition was created. It was printed as a printed book. Later on, it was digitized by the Goenka people under the Vipassana Research Institute. A Thai mob called the Dhamma Society took the Goenka version and then spent 3 years proofreading and correcting it. And they came up with what they call the Mahasangiti edition, and that is what we have on Sutta Central. All right. So I'm telling you this because I think it's important for us to understand something of the material background that underlies and informs our practice. I mentioned before when we were talking about meditation that when we meditate, the words that we've heard will condition what we meditate with. So we should be careful about that. We should take time to investigate it. Now, I'm going to ask you another question. Okay, so this was created from a digital text. It was created from a book, right? A set of books published by the Burmese Sangha Council. And the monks at the Sixth Council were running that show, and they had their text that they did that. Ultimately, where they learnt it from was from manuscripts, palm leaf manuscripts, or they call ola leaf manuscripts. Okay, so the text for about nearly 2,000 years were passed down on ola leaf manuscripts. So when they were reading those manuscripts, how old do you think those manuscripts were? Like the manuscripts that our modern editions were prepared from, how old do you think that they were? 6th century?
5th or
6th. So that would be about 1,500 years old? Yeah? How long does a palm leaf last? Good question. Any other? How old do you think that these texts that we're relying? Like, just stop and think about it for a minute. We think we know what the Dhamma is, right? And it depends on what these texts say. So if we've got it wrong, I mean, they had a big problem in Germany in about like the 15th century because they published a translation of the Bible and they left the word not out of the seventh commandment. Thou shalt commit adultery. And everyone was like, God, you've been fooling us for all these years. So one word can change quite a bit. So how old? We've had one estimate of 1,500 years. Anybody else can tell us? How old do you reckon?
A few centuries.
Sorry?
40, 50 years.
40, 50 years? And the back a few centuries?
5th century
BC? Okay. That's hitting hard there. 5th century BC. That would be great. But I like your ambition. Anyone else? Right.
That's the oldest physical text.
So, and how old are they?
I'm not sure if it's first or second, but it's the early part of the Common
Era. Right, so nearly 2,000 years old. So they're the Gandhari texts, they're the oldest ones. So we have some of those on sort of Central. And you can see over here in Dahari. And we actually have that here. So this is a modern edition, again a digitized edition of the Rhinoceros Sutta in Gandhari. And this is prepared from a manuscript that's nearly 2,000 years old. Of course, yes, this is a Romanized version. With the images. So this is prepared from scanned images of the manuscript. They're available. We don't have them on sort of separate. They're available. We do have probably have a picture somewhere. Yeah.
Plus, there's things that could not be read from the original.
Right. So these are broken parts of the manuscript.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So. Okay. So. Okay, so we're getting some idea of this, and we haven't still got a consensus on this. We've had everything from, I think, was it 40 years, you said? To a few hundred, to 1,500, to 2,500. So what does that tell you? It tells you that we don't know anything. Right? Right? Yeah, I mean, it's curious. I mean, I go around kind of talking about these things all over the place, and you really have to sort of go back and just explain a lot of these really basic concepts, like what's a manuscript? People don't understand what's the difference between a manuscript and a text, right? A manuscript is a physical object that a text is written down in. Anyway, so all of the Pali texts that we've had, which means all of the Pali that you have ever read in your life, comes from manuscripts no earlier than the 18th and 19th centuries. Okay? No earlier than the 18th and 19th centuries. And these were collected, whether by the European scholars of the Pali Text Society or for the various Asian editions, and compiled into the modern books that we today call the Pali Tripitaka. Another little interesting detail, I was in Colombo not long ago, 6 months ago, and they're starting a project for the Tripitaka there. And as part of that, they're traveling all around Sri Lanka to go to all of the temples to find, to identify a particular manuscript edition of the Tripitaka on which to base their new edition, right? So they want to go all the temples and find what's the best set of manuscripts that we can use, okay? And so far they've been to about 80% of the places in Sri Lanka. Remembering that Sri Lanka, of course, is the oldest continuous Buddhist country and the one that has the proudest tradition of the Pali text and everything. And in all of those, they have yet to find a monastery that has a full set of the manuscripts of the Tripitaka. Okay? So, I mean, they've got the full Tripitaka in the printed editions. They've probably got full Tripitakas in the sense of, like, having different manuscripts, but, like, having one edition where someone has made a set of the Tripitaka in one manuscript, they haven't found yet. They found one from the, I think, early 19th century, which had all but about two or three books, so had fairly complete, but they hadn't yet found a single monastery that had one coherent edition or manuscript edition of the Tripitaka. Interesting, right? Okay, so the earliest Pali text, which is one of the projects that we're doing at Sutta Central, is we're doing a project with the earliest Pali manuscript, which is what you can see in front of you. And this is a manuscript which is in the Colombo National Museum, and we call it the Dutiya Parakrama Bahu Chulavaga. So the Chulavaga is a book of the Vinaya. Dutiya Parakrama Bahu was a king of Sri Lanka in about 13th century, and he commissioned this text. So this is from the 13th century. And this is the oldest Pali manuscript, the oldest complete book in Pali. There's a few scraps and inscriptions and bits and pieces that are older, but this is the oldest complete manuscript. There, that's what you're seeing in front of you. Nice, huh? Yeah, beautifully written. So to do this, they have to prepare all the leaves and roll them out and get them ready, and then they inscribe them with a metal stylus, and then when they're inscribed, then they put a dye over it and brush the dye off, and that's what keeps the colour. You can see it's obviously it's fragmenting and broken a bit in some places, but by and large, is quite well preserved. So we are currently part of a team in Sutta Central is working on creating a digital edition of this particular text. And so this will be the first time that there'll be a substantial Buddhist text published from a manuscript this early. And this is one of the things we want to learn about, for example, is how reliable was the transmission? I mean, we assume the transmission's reliable. We hope it is. And we have good reasons for that. Yeah, I mean, we're not just kind of making stuff up. I mean, there are strong linguistic and cultural and other clues that are telling us that this thing was passed down reliably, but we don't have actually the material witness to that. So this is giving us a material witness for a much older text. So, right. So where were we? Oh, yes, that's right. We were on the Evamme Sutta. So now we've got some idea of what that tradition is of passing down the Evamme Sutta and so on. And I want to come to you. Now, that manuscript that I was just showing you is the Chulavagga, right? And we haven't transcribed it yet, so I won't read directly from that manuscript, but one of the chapters of the Chulavagga, so one of the chapters included in that manuscript, is the account of the First Council. All right? Panchasatika Khandaka. Okay? Yeah? We good? And let's see what it has in that account of the First Council. And remember, I'm coming back to this thing about Evamme Sutta. I won't go through the whole story, but it begins with the Buddha passing away, with one of the monks saying, some of the monks being distressed and horrified, the Buddha was passed away. Other monks saying we should be equanimous when the Buddha passes away. And one of the monks was even saying, now, don't grieve that the Buddha's passed away. Sumutta mayang dena mahasamanena. Now we are well rid of that great monk. He used to always worry us, upadruta, by saying, you're allowed to do this, you're not allowed to do that. Now, yang ichisama dang karisama, we will do whatever we want. Yang na ichisama natang karisama, and what we don't want to do, we won't do. Sounds good, right? So, when Mahakasapa heard this monk saying that, he said, let's not do this, let's hold a sanghiti, dhammancha vinayancha sanghayama, and before the what is not dhamma appears, and before what is dhamma disappears, before what is not vinaya appears, and what is vinaya disappears. So then they called together the monks to have a council. And it is worth noting that the Buddha himself referred to the holding of a council, of a sanghiti, after he passed away. And he said, this is how you should sustain the sasana, by coming together and reciting the teachings in harmony. But when the Buddha spoke of this, he invariably said that after I pass away, the monks, the nuns, the lay men, and the lay women should gather together, and they should recite the Dhamma in unity and concord and harmony for the long lasting of the sasana. That's what the Buddha said. But that's not what happened. What happened was the monks came along and said, no, you guys, out. We're going to do it. Interesting, right? Okay, so Mahakasapa was doing it. Then they agreed to have a Sangha Sanghiti. And he first of all, they discussed the Vinaya, and he asked Venerable Upali about the Vinaya. And those of you who are the monastics here especially, or who know a little bit of Pali, will note that the proceedings of the council are carried out as a Vinaya Kamma. right? Sunatu me avuso sangho. So these are formal sort of legal phrases which are used to announce that this is a Vinaya act. And after he questions Venerable Upali, he then questions Venerable Ananda. And of course, many of you probably know there's a whole backstory of Ananda and Kassapa and various issues that they had together. So it might have been a little awkward at this point to be doing this whole kind of thing. But anyway, this is what they did. So what it says here, and I'm finally returning to your point about the Eva Mesutan, what it says here is, So then Venerable Mahakasapa informed the Sangha. Sunatu me avaso sangha. Please, may this reference sangha hear me. Yadi sangasa patakalang zahang anandang dhamang pucheyan. So if the sangha is ready, I will question Venerable Ananda about the dhamma. And then Ananda informed the sangha, if the sangha is ready, I will answer when questioned by Mahakasapa. So it's a very kind of orderly procedure, right? So you can see how they're kind of framing it in a way that by making, like, this is very much how Sanghakama works, yeah? And one of the reasons, I'm reading this for you because it's not just a historical information, but this is giving you an insight into how the Sangha works. Like, this is how we do our Sanghakamas, right? The procedures are very explicit and very clear, and everybody's informed along the way. Yadi Sanghasa Patakalang. It's not like, this is what we're doing, deal with it, right? If the Sangha is ready, this is what we do. Now, I mentioned before, it's problematic because the monks have already excluded the nuns, the laymen and the laywomen. Right? And that shouldn't have happened, in my view. But they did. So that's a problem with this whole process. On the other hand, there's also positives with the way that things are done. In the way you can see this use of the Sangha Karma, it makes the proceedings very explicit and very consensual. Okay? Everybody agrees. And in Sangha, in the proceedings of the Sangha, no monk and no nun has any authority whatsoever. It doesn't exist. There's no such thing as patriarchy or authority within the Sangha, according to the Vinaya. All right? Of course it exists in the world out there, right? But in the Vinaya, no. In the Vinaya, every monk is equal within the monks' assembly. Every nun is equal within the nuns' assembly. And any question can be asked, and any decision that's been made must be made by the Sangha as a whole, not by the individual monks or nuns. Also important to remember that the monk Sangha has no authority over the nun Sangha. No monk can ever tell a nun to do anything. Right? No senior can tell a junior to do anything. In fact, the Vinaya explicitly says that the juniors should disobey their seniors if they're being asked to do something which is wrong. Right? Even if it's your teacher or your preceptor, and if they ask you to do something which is against the Dhamma or the Vinaya, you should disobey them. Okay? So you remember that. If they ever ask you to do something that's wrong, so we're just stopping by the store. I want you to just run in, nick some stuff from the store for me, and then we'll quickly drive away. No! Do not do it. Don't say, yes, great guru, I want to do it. No. If they ask you to do something that's wrong, you can't do it. Right? And so within the Sangha, as laid down by the Buddha, seniority is about guidance and about respect, but it's not about power. Okay. Anyhow, so Kassapa is asking then Ananda about this. Ataka ayasma mahakassapo ayasma dang anandang etadavocha. Then Mahakasapa asked Venerable Ananda, Brahma Jala Ngavuso Ananda Gatta Bahasitam. Where was the Brahma Jala spoken? Now, Brahma Jala, of course, referring to the Brahma Jala Sutta, currently the first sutta in the Digha Nikaya, that is the first of all of the suttas. Antaracha Bhante Rajagahang Antaracha Nalandang Rajagarke Ambalatikayati. It was spoken, Venerable Sir, in between Rajagaha and Nalanda in the Ambalatika townlet, or what was it, hamlet? How do you translate Rajagaha? Okay. Anyway, whatever. What was it spoken about, Kangarabha? It was spoken, or who was it spoken in regard to? The Supiya, the wanderer, and Brahmadatta, his student. And then Mahakasapa questioned Venerable Ananda about the origin, the source, the Nidana of the Brahmajala, and about the persons. Then he goes on, then Samanyapala Banavaso Ananda Gatta Bahasitam. Where was the Samanyapala? The second sutra in the discourse, Adiga Nikaya, the fruit of asceticism. Where was that spoken? In Rajagaha, and so on. So you can see here is telling you the procedure. Now, I don't want to take this literally. Actually, the different vinayas will tell a slightly different version of that, okay? But it's giving you something about the idea of the procedures. But what it doesn't say there is anything about Evam Me Sutam. Right? Actually, it quite excludes that, because the setting is spoken as a set of questions and answers between Kassapa and Ananda. Yeah? And Ananda is not depicted. The earliest record, the actual record we have of the First Council, says nothing about Ananda saying Eva Me Sutam. Yeah? So there's no early record of Eva Me Sutam being used in that way. The description of the context that we have is used in that way. And when other phrases are used, they're used in that sense. So this is why I think there's quite a strong argument to be said that Eva Me Sutam does not mean what Ananda spoke at the First Council, but rather it means that this is an indication of something that's passed down through an oral tradition. Right. So this is how we work with textual arguments. Right? So none of the arguments and ideas and so on that we have about things, they're not certain. Right? We're not working on the basis of certainty, but we're working on the basis of kind of judgment and so on and so forth. Does that help understand?
I'm just wondering what the earliest commentary is so about it, because it seems to me that they would discuss it extensively.
The earliest commentary?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, obviously we have the Pali commentary, but whether that's the earliest commentary on that particular passage, I wouldn't be sure. Yeah. I'm sure there'd be discussions of it in some Chinese vineyards and things like that as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's right, yeah. Be interesting to look it up. Yeah. Because it's from the Pali commentaries that we get this idea that that was Ananda who was saying that, right? So those commentaries are then 1,000 years later.
So what comes to my mind in the Mahayana Sutra,
right?
This Evam Me Sutam
is right.
Conceived as a stamp of authenticity,
right.
So many from other traditions would say that this sutra was authentic.
Right, yeah. Right, so it could well be that that already was regarded in that way as being a stamp of authenticity at that very early time. Yeah, quite likely, yeah. Okay, so how's everyone going? You going okay? You still with me? Yeah, now I can keep on going about this stuff for ages. I wanted to talk to you about vows of silence. Remember we talked about that before? I haven't forgotten. Do you want to do that? Maybe we'll have a look at a bit about vows of silence and then we can go back to it. Can anybody remember which one of the khandakas that's in? I think it's in the Upposita it must be in the Vaso khandaka. Yeah, it must be.
I'm sorry. Before you move on, can I ask those?
Please,
yeah. So what I'm hearing from you, this was not included, does have occurred, was not included in the original, so it's kind of developed later on.
I think so, yeah.
Authenticity
or what? So it was originally used as a signifier to say that this is what's been passed down through the oral tradition.
So why do we accept that? Why can't we go back to the original one?
Because it doesn't exist.
Because
we haven't built a time machine. Right? Sorry, could you say that again? Oh, interesting. Okay. Right. Right. Okay. So could you understand what I was saying there? Did you hear it? No. Okay. So thank you for that. It's a very good point. That when we in our modern conditioning receive a text, we assume that a text is something which is written down. But earlier in human culture, most texts and so on were passed down in oral tradition. Now, the way that that oral tradition works varies from time to place, right? But oral tradition itself is extremely widespread. Now, the Buddhist texts were passed down in an oral tradition for at least, like, say, 500 years or so before they were written down. And there were reasons for that. Like, I can imagine all of the old monks in those days would have been going, ah, I see these young monks with all this technology they're using and they're writing down these scriptures. It's not like it was in the old days when I was a young monk. We have to know them all by heart. You know, this one is in here, not just write them down on a manuscript and stick it in the monastery library and who cares, you can forget about it. That's what I imagined that the monks would have been saying in those days. But it's a big difference, right? If you know something by heart, it's in your heart. Yeah, and you know it. And if you, when you need it, it's there. So actually the oral tradition is still alive, right? I mean, we still memorize Pali texts, we still memorize the Padimokkha and so on, but the main means of transmission is the written transmission. Now, because we're used to the written transmission, we tend to assume that the written transmission is more reliable, right? Because we have a book, and the book is still the same as it was last week, but our memory of what we read in that book, So, you know, often when I do Dhamma talks, you know, or if I ask somebody after a Dhamma talk, you know, was it a good Dhamma talk? Yeah, it's great. I really enjoyed it. What was it about? Yeah, it was really good. Yeah. And, and so we've trained ourselves to, we've really trained our minds in different ways, right? But of course, it is possible to remember things, and we can remember, passages from suttas and passages from the Vinaya for many years with letter perfect accuracy. I learnt the Padimokkha 20 something years ago, and if I wanted to, I could write it down, you know, almost letter by letter today. And if you train yourself, then you know how to do that. And the point that I was making is a very good one. If you make a printed edition, you write something out, like those manuscripts I was looking at before, you know, if a monk makes a mistake, which they do, of course, right? You make a mistake when you're writing those things out. They all have, all manuscripts have mistakes in them. Then that's it. It's just there. Whereas if you're reciting, and if you're reciting together with other people, when you make a mistake, they can hear it. Right? And so this is that idea. It's literally what sangiti means, is reciting together. So it's getting together and doing that chanting, and then you're always checking each other and reinforcing your memory. So this is the way that it was passed down, and that cultural technology of passing down letter-perfect texts was developed to a very high degree in the Indic culture, both in the among the Brahmins for the Vedas and then in the Buddhists. So I'm just seeing if we've got this. So this is another. So we're now in the Vinaya, the Vasupanayaka Khandaka, the chapter on spending the rains retreat, and we are looking at a passage on, a passage on. So this is the passage where this is the part of the Vinaya where the Buddha, It's the passage of the Buddha where he gives the reasons why the Sangha should be staying in one place for the rains retreat. Can anyone tell me, what's the rains retreat about? Yeah? Okay, yeah.
We didn't want the monks walking around and trampling on the plants.
Yep.
So the Buddha said they should not retreat at that time.
Okay, yeah, good. Thank you. So that's that. And maybe it's not in here.
No, because they have many
Right. Yeah, I tried that. I don't think so. I think it's in a different Kandika. Ah, maybe, yeah, the Upasatha Kandika, yeah. That's more likely. I'd prefer to look at the Pali. Okay, so I don't seem to be here either. All right. No, it doesn't seem to be here either. That's bad, isn't it? No one here can remember the. Well, I do apologize. We are supposed to be the experts. And yet, as you think it's Mugabhata, don't word no. Sheep. See, all the monastics know exactly the passage that I'm talking about. But I'm having a little bit of trouble finding it. Okay, if I can't find it in a second, I'll leave it for now and we'll come back to it a bit later on. No, there's too many things about sheep in there. I'll have to go and search for it again. I'm surprised I can't find it. It's a bit embarrassing, isn't it? All right. Okay, so what's the time now? 1:53. I tell you what, we've been back here for a little while already. We're going to have to finish off at 4, right? So why don't we have a break and we can get up, stretch our legs, have a cup of tea, come back maybe in 15, 20 minutes, and then we can maybe do some meditation and then we can finish off the afternoon. Okay, and meanwhile I will search for this passage which I've embarrassingly been unable to find. Okay, so see you back here in about, what's the time now, about 10 past 2. Okay? Alright. Why can't we find that? Varanas. Yeah. Of course, right?
obviously. Tang inam swang now, so more for it. This should be a stand now, the bottom pop out.
Okay, good.
Because of the expansion. How do you type in Pali? Like, your keyboard? Do you have a keyboard that you use?
No, well, I mean, to search on Sitter Central, you don't have to use the diacritical marks, you can just type. But if you want to type the diacritical marks, yes, you can. I mean, this is Linux, so that because Linux is free and open source, so it's better than everything else, and you can just type it. But if you have an inferior operating system, like Windows or Mac, you can install another piece of software and do it the complicated and hard way. Sorry,
hello.
Yes, hello.
Yes,
how are you doing? What's your name?
Tanya.
Tanya, how are you going, Tanya?
Very good. So I'm wanting to ask a dumb question that I was shy to ask in front of everybody.
Please, I live for dumb questions.
Yes, all right, good. So
I'm just going to stretch my legs.
Yes. So if it is an oral tradition, like I cannot even imagine how much time, how much memory resources it would take besides all this shit that. So what is the volume that any given monastery would be able to actually actively grasp?
So that one of the things that they meant to be council, right? Of course, right? One of the things that they did in the first council was that they divided the civil government into two parts. So the new rule is like one monastery, one teacher might specialize in one part. Yeah? Today we might know one part. And then within that, you might further subdivide. So you might have a few core sutras that everyone would have. And then I need to make another 10 or 20 parts of that. And then the more challenging might find a whole new part. Like a really good one, but then go to the other monastery and then learn the other one. So that's the breaking it up and then all the class in the Sunday so that everyone learns some of it and how they do this. Right?